And love is not something that is given or taken away by another, but is created from within. Acceptance is not to be confused with passivity, which is a symptom of apathy. This form of acceptance allows engagement in life on life's own terms, without trying to make it conform to an agenda. With acceptance, there is emotional calm and perception is widened as denial is transcended. One now sees things without distortion or misinterpretation. The context of experience is expanded so that one is capable of seeing the whole picture. Acceptance has to do essentially with balance, proportion, and appropriateness. The individual at the level of acceptance is not interested in determining right or wrong, but instead is dedicated to resolving issues and finding out what to do about problems. Tough jobs do not cause discomfort or dismay. Long-term goals take precedence over short-term ones. Self-discipline and mastery are prominent. At the level of acceptance, we are not polarized by conflict or opposition. We see that other people have the same rights as we do, and we honor equality. While lower levels are characterized by rigidity, at this level, social plurality begins to emerge as a form of resolution of problems. Therefore, this level is free of discrimination and intolerance. There is an awareness that equality does not preclude diversity. Acceptance includes rather than rejects.
Energy level 400. Reason.
Intelligence and rationality rise to the forefront when the emotionalism of the lower levels is transcended. Reason is capable of handling large, complex amounts of data and making rapid, correct decisions. It's capable of understanding the intricacies of relationships, gradations, and fine distinctions, and also of expert manipulation of symbols as abstract concepts, which become increasingly important. This is the level of science, medicine, and of generally increased capability for conceptualization and comprehension. Knowledge and education are sought as capital. Understanding and information are the main tools of accomplishment, which is the hallmark of the 400 level. This is the level of Nobel Prize winners, great statesmen, Supreme Court justices, Einstein, Freud, and many other important figures in the history of thought calibrate here, and the authors of the great books of the Western world calibrate here. The shortcomings of this level are failure to clearly distinguish the difference between symbols and what they represent, and confusion between the objective and subjective worlds that limits the understanding of causality. At this level, it's easy to lose sight of the forest for the trees. You become infatuated with concepts and theories and ending up in intellectualism and missing the essential point. Intellectualizing can become an end in itself. Reason is limited in that it does not afford the capacity for the discernment of essence or the critical point of a complex issue, and generally disregards context. Reason does not of itself provide a guide to truth. It produces massive amounts of information and documentation, but lacks the capability to resolve discrepancies in data and conclusions. All philosophic arguments sound convincing on their own. Although reason is highly effective in a technical world where the methodologies of logic dominate, reason itself, paradoxically, is the major block to reaching higher levels of consciousness, and transcending this level is relatively uncommon in our society, by only 4%.
Energy level 500. Love.
Love, as it is depicted in the mass media, is not what this level implies. On the contrary, what the world generally refers to as love is an intense emotionality combining physical attraction, possessiveness, control, even addiction, eroticism, novelty. It is usually evanescent and fluctuating, waxing and waning with varying conditions. When frustrated, this emotion often reveals an underlying anger and dependency that it had masked. That love can turn to hate is a common concept, but what is being spoken about then, rather than love, is an addictive sentimentality and an attachment. Hate stems from pride, not love. There probably never was actual love, therefore, in such a relationship. The 500 level is characterized by the development of a love which is unconditional, unchanging, and permanent. It does not fluctuate because its source within the person who loves is not dependent on external conditions. Loving is a state of being. It is a way of relating to the world, which is forgiving, nurturing, and supportive. Love is not intellectual and does not proceed from the mind. Love emanates from the heart. It has the capacity to lift others and accomplish great feats because of the purity of its motive. At this level of development, the capacity to discern essence becomes more predominant. The core of an issue becomes the center of focus. As reason is bypassed, there arises the capacity for instantaneous recognition of the totality of a problem and a major expansion of context, especially regarding time and process. Reason deals only with particulars, whereas love deals with wholes. This ability, often ascribed to intuition, is the capacity for instantaneously understanding without resort to sequential symbol processing. This apparently abstract phenomenon is, in fact, quite concrete. It is accompanied by a measurable release of endorphins in the brain. Love takes no position and thus is global, rising above the separation of positionality. It is then possible to be one with another, as there are no longer any barriers. Love is therefore inclusive and expands the sense of self progressively. Love focuses on the goodness of life in all its expressions and augments that which is positive. It dissolves negativity by recontextualizing it rather than by attacking it. This is the level of true happiness, but although the world is fascinated with the subject of love, and all viable religions calibrate at 500 or over, it is interesting to note that only 0.4% of the world's population ever reaches this level of the evolution of consciousness.
Energy level 540. Joy.
As love becomes more and more unconditional, it begins to be experienced as an inner joy. This is not the sudden joy of a pleasurable turn of events. It is a constant accompaniment to all activities. Joy arises from within each moment of existence, rather than from any external source. 540 is also the level of healing and of spiritually based self-help groups. From level 540 up is the domain of saints, spiritual healers, and advanced spiritual students. Characteristic of this energy field is the capacity for enormous patience and the persistence of a positive attitude in the face of prolonged adversity. The hallmark of this state is compassion. People who have attained this level have a notable effect on others. They are capable of prolonged open visual gaze, which induces a state of love and peace. At the high 500s, the world one sees is illuminated by the exquisite beauty and perfection of creation. Everything happens effortlessly by synchronicity, and the world and everything in it is seen to be an expression of love and divinity. Individual will merges into divine will. A presence is felt whose power facilitates phenomena outside conventional expectations of reality, termed miraculous by the ordinary observer. These phenomena represent the power of the energy field, not that of the individual. One's sense of responsibility for others at this level is of a different quality from that shown at the lower levels. There is a desire to use one's state of consciousness for the benefit of life itself rather than for particular individuals. This capacity to love many people simultaneously is accompanied by the discovery that the more one loves, the more one can love. Near-death experiences, characteristically transformative in their effect, frequently have allowed people to experience the energy level between 540 and 600.
Energy level 600. Peace.
This energy field is associated with the experience designated by such terms as transcendence, self-realization, and God consciousness. It is extremely rare. When this state is reached, the distinction between subject and object disappears, and there is no specific focal point of perception. Not uncommonly, individuals at this level remove themselves from the world, as the state of bliss that ensues precludes ordinary activity. Some become spiritual teachers. Others work anonymously for the betterment of mankind. A few become great geniuses in their respective fields and make major contributions to society. These people are saintly and may eventually even be designated officially as so, though at this level, formal religion is commonly transcended, to be replaced by the pure spirituality out of which all religion originates. Perception at the level of 600 and above is sometimes reported as occurring in slow motion, suspended in time and space. Though nothing is stationary, all is alive and radiant. Although this world is the same world as seen by others, it has become continuously flowing, evolving in an exquisitely coordinated evolutionary dance, in which significance and source are overwhelming. This awesome revelation takes place non-rationally, so that there is an infinite silence in the mind which has stopped conceptualizing. That which is witnessing and that which is witnessed take on the same identity. The observer dissolves into the landscape and becomes equally the observed. Everything is connected to everything else by a presence whose power is infinite, exquisitely gentle, yet rock-like. Great works of art, music, and architecture, which calibrate between 600 and 700, can transport us temporarily to higher levels of consciousness and are universally recognized as inspirational and timeless.
Energy level 700 to 1000, enlightenment.
This is the level of the great ones of history who originated the spiritual patterns which multitudes have followed throughout the ages. All are associated with divinity with which they are often identified. It is the level of powerful inspiration. These beings set in place attractor energy fields which influence all of mankind down through the ages. At this level, there is no longer the experience of an individual personal self as separate from others. Rather, there is an identification of self, with a capital S, with consciousness and divinity. The unmanifest is experienced as self, with a capital S, beyond mind. This transcendence of the ego also serves by example to teach others how this can eventually be accomplished. This is the peak of the evolution of consciousness in the human realm. Great teachings uplift the masses and raise the level of awareness of all of humanity. To have such vision is called grace, and the gift it brings is peace, described as ineffable beyond words. At this level of realization, the sense of one's existence transcends all time and all individuality. There is no longer identification with the physical body as if it were me, and therefore its fate is really of no concern. The body is seen as merely a tool of consciousness. Through the intervention of mind, its prime value, that of communication, the small self merges back into the large self. This is the level of non-duality or complete oneness. There is no localization of consciousness. Awareness is everywhere equally present. Great works of art depicting individuals who have reached the level of enlightenment characteristically show the teacher with a specific hand position called the mudra, wherein the palm of the hand radiates benediction. This is the act of the transmission of this energy field to the consciousness of mankind. This level of divine grace calibrates up to 1,000, the highest level attained by any persons who have ever lived in recorded history, to wit, the great avatars, to whom the title Lord is appropriate, Lord Krishna, Lord Buddha, Lord Jesus Christ.
Chapter 5, Social Distribution of Consciousness Levels. General Description.
A graphic representation of the distribution of the respective energy levels among the world's population would resemble the shape of a pagoda, in that 85% of the race is below the critical level of 200, while the overall average level of human consciousness today is approximately 204. The power of the relatively few individuals near the top counterbalances the energy of the masses toward the bottom to achieve this overall average. As mentioned, only 0.4% of the world's population calibrates in an energy field of 500 or over. A level of consciousness calibrating at 600 or over is reached by only one in many millions. At first glance, these figures may seem improbable, but if we examine world conditions, we will quickly be reminded that the populations of whole continents live at a bare subsistence level. Famine and disease are commonplace, frequently accompanied by political oppression, and paucity of social resources, many of such people live in a state of hopelessness, calibrating at the level of apathy and resignation to their abject poverty. We must also realize that much of the remainder of the world's population, civilized as well as primitive, live primarily in the world of fear. The majority of humans spend their lives in a quest for one form or another of security. Those whose lifestyles transcend the imperative of survival so as to allow discretionary options then become grist for the desire-driven world economic mill, and success in the attainment of desires leads at best to pride. Any meaningful human satisfaction cannot even commence until about the level of 250, where some degree of self-confidence begins to emerge as the basis for positive life experiences in the evolution of consciousness.
Cultural correlations.
The energy fields below 200 are most common in extremely primitive conditions where people eke out bare subsistence. Clothing is sparse, illiteracy is the rule. Infant mortality is high. Disease and malnutrition are widespread, and there is a vacuum of social power. Skills are rudimentary and center around fuel and food gathering and shelter preparation, and there is total dependence on the vagaries of the immediate environment. This is really a Stone Age tribal cultural level, little more than an animal existence. Populations characterized by the low 200s are typified by unskilled labor, rudimentary trade, the building of simple artifacts such as dugout canoes and temporary housing. Mobility begins to express itself in the nomadic lifestyle. And in populations that average a somewhat higher consciousness, agriculture first appears and barter evolves into the use of a token currency. The mid-200s are associated with semi-skilled labor. Simple but life-sustaining housing and food economy become dependably available. Clothing is adequate and elementary education begins. The high 200s are represented by skilled labor, blue-collar workers, tradesmen, retail commerce, and industries. At lower levels, for example, fishing is an individual or a tribal activity, but above the mid-200s, it becomes an industry. At the level of 300, we find technicians, skilled and advanced craftsmen, managers, and more sophisticated business structure. Completion of secondary education becomes customary. There is an interest in style, sport, and public entertainment, and television, of course, is the great pastime. In the mid-300s, we find upper management, artisans, and educators, informed awareness of public events, and a worldview that extends beyond the tribe, neighborhood, or city to the nation at large and its welfare. Social dialogue becomes a meaningful matter of interest. Survival has been assured by the acquisition of skills and information adequate to function as a civilized society. There is social mobility and flexibility and resources which enable a limited amount of travel and other stimulating recreation. The 400s are the level of the awakening of the intellect, the locus of true literacy, higher education, the professional class, executives, scientists. The home, devoid of reading material at the lower levels, now exhibits magazines, periodicals, and full bookcases. There is an interest in educational broadcast channels and a more sophisticated political awareness. There is greater communication, adeptness, intellectual preoccupation, as well as artistic creativity are common. Recreational activities take the form of chess, travel, theater, concerts. Civic enterprises intended to enhance the social milieu receive serious attention. Supreme Court justices, presidents, statesmen, inventors, and leaders of industry occupy this general range. Because education is the underpinning of this level, individuals tend to gather in metropolitan areas where they have access to sources of information and instruction, such as the great universities. Some aspire to faculty status, others become lawyers or members of other professional classes. The welfare of one's fellow man is a common concern, though not yet a driving force. The high 400s are associated with leaders in their respective fields and with high social prestige, accomplishment, and corresponding social trappings. Both Einstein and Freud calibrated at 499. But while the 400s are the level of universities and doctorates, they are also the source of the limited and limiting Newtonian vision of the universe and of the Cartesian split between mind and body. Interestingly, both Newton and Descartes calibrated at 499. Just as the level 200 demarcates a critical change of consciousness, 500 is a point at which awareness makes another great leap. Although survival of the individual is still important, the motivation of love begins to color all activities, and creativity comes into full expression, accompanied by commitment, dedication, and expressions of charisma. Here, excellence is common in every field of human endeavor, from sport to scientific investigation. Altruism becomes a motivating factor, along with dedication to principles. Leadership is accepted rather than sought. From this level emerges great music, art, and architecture, and the capacity to uplift others by one's mere presence. In the upper 500s are found inspirational leaders who set an example for the rest of society, and in their respective fields create new paradigms with far-reaching implications for all of mankind. Although well aware of themselves that they still have defects and limitations, people on this level are often seen by the general public as out of the ordinary and may be recognized with emblems of distinction. Many in the mid-500s begin to have spiritual experiences of profound import and become immersed in spiritual pursuit. Some astonish their friends and families by sudden breakthroughs into new subjective contexts of reality. Consciousness at this level can be described as visionary and may focus on uplifting society as a whole. From this level, a few make the great leap to the region which calibrates at 600. At this point, an individual's life may become legendary. The signature of the 600s is compassion, which pervades all motivation and activities.
Progression of consciousness.
Although the levels we have described span great variation, it is not common for individuals to move from one level to another during one lifetime. The energy field which is calibrated for an individual at birth only increases on average by about 5 points. That an individual's level of consciousness is already in effect at birth is a sobering fact with profound implications. Consciousness itself and its expression as human civilization evolves slowly indeed through numerous generations. The majority of people utilize their life experiences to elaborate and express the variations of their native energy field. It is the rare individual who manages to really move beyond it, although many people make considerable internal improvements. The reason for this is more easily understandable when we see that what defines one's level is motivation. Motivation proceeds from meaning, and meaning in turn is an expression of context. Thus, achievement is bounded by context, which, when correspondingly aligned with motivation, determines the individual's relative power. The average advance of 5 points in a lifetime is, of course, a statistical figure, reduced by, among other things, the fact that people's cumulative life choices not uncommonly result in a net lowering of their level of consciousness. As will be enumerated in detail later, the influence of a very few individuals of advanced consciousness counterbalances whole populations at the lower levels. But conversely, the extreme negativity of a few individuals can sway entire cultures and produce a global drag on the general level of consciousness, as history illustrates all too well. Kinesiologic testing indicates that a mere 2.6% of the human population, identifiable by an abnormal kinesiologic polarity, in that they test strong to negative attractors and weak to positive ones, account for 72% of society's problems. Nonetheless, it is possible for isolated individuals to make sudden positive jumps, even of hundreds of points. If one can truly escape the egocentric entrainment of the sub-200 attractor fields, consciously choosing a friendly, earnest, kind, and forgiving approach to life, and eventually making charity towards others one's primary focus, higher levels can certainly be attained, at least in theory. In practice, however, great will is required. Thus, though it is not ordinary to move out of one's energy field into another during one lifetime, the opportunity still exists. It remains for motivation to activate that potential. Without the exercise of choice, no progression will occur. It is well to reemphasize that the progression of the calibrated power levels is logarithmic. Thus, individual choice can have a mighty effect. The difference in power level, for instance, between 361.0 and 361.1 can be very significant, and are even capable of transforming one's life and one's effect on the world at large.
Chapter 6, New Horizons in Research.
Our concern thus far has been primarily to elucidate the structure and the anatomy of consciousness with some reference to the mechanisms of force and power. But ours is in no sense a purely theoretical subject. The unique nature of the research method described herein allows exploration of hitherto inaccessible areas of potential knowledge. It is as applicable to the most prosaic practical questions as it is to the most advanced theoretical explorations. Let's investigate a few general examples.
Social problems.
Drug and alcohol addiction is a crucial social concern which feeds parallel problems of crime, poverty, and welfare. Addiction has proved an intractable social and clinical problem, thus far not understood beyond the most basic description. By the term addiction, we mean clinical addiction, in the classical sense of continued dependence on alcohol or a drug, despite serious consequences. A condition exceeding the capacity of the addicted person to discontinue use of the substance unaided, because the will itself has been rendered ineffective. But what is the essential nature of addiction, and to what is the addict really addicted? The common belief is that it is the addictive substance itself to which the victim has become addicted, because of that substance's power to create a high state of euphoria. But if we re-examine the nature of addiction through the methodology described, a different formulation of the process emerges. Alcohol or drugs do not in themselves have the power to create a high at all. They calibrate at only 100, which is the same as the level of vegetables. The so-called high that the drug or alcohol user experiences can calibrate from 350 up to 600. The actual effect of drugs is merely to suppress the lower energy fields, thereby allowing the user to experience exclusively only the higher ones. It is as though a filter screened out all of the lower tones coming from an orchestra, so that all that could be heard were the high notes. The suppression of the low notes does not create the high ones. It merely reveals their presence. Within the levels of consciousness, the higher frequencies are extremely powerful, and few people routinely experience these as pure states because they are masked by lower energy fields such as anxiety, fear, anger, resentment, etc. Rarely does the average person get to experience, for instance, love without fear or pure joy, much less ecstasy. But these higher states are so powerful that once experienced, they are never forgotten and are sought ever after. It is to this experience of higher states that people become addicted. A good illustration is presented in the classic movie Lost Horizon. Shangri-La, the movie's metaphor for unconditional love and beauty, calibrates at 600. Once experienced, it reprograms the experiencer so that they will never be content again with ordinary consciousness. The hero of the movie discovers this fact when he is unable to find happiness again in the ordinary world after returning from Shangri-La. He then gives up everything in order to seek out and return to that state of consciousness, spending years in the struggle, which almost costs him his life, to regain and find Shangri-La again. This same reprogramming process occurs in people who have reached high states of consciousness by other means, such as the experience of samadhi through meditation, or near-death experiences. Such individuals are frequently observed to have changed forever. It is not uncommon for them to leave all that the material world represents and become seekers after truth. Many who had transcended experiences with LSD in the 1960s did that very same thing. Such higher states are also attained through the experiences of love, religion, classical music or art, or through the practice of spiritual disciplines. The high state which people seek, by whatever means, is in fact the experience field of their own consciousness, self for the capital S. If they are spiritually unsophisticated and lack a context with which to comprehend the experience, they believe it is created from something out there, such as a guru, music, drug, lover, whatever. All that has actually happened is that under special circumstances, they have experienced their own inner reality. The majority of people are so divorced from their own states of pure consciousness that they do not recognize them when they experience them because they identify with their lower ego states. A negative self-image blots out the joyous brilliance that is the true essence of their identities, which therefore goes unrecognized. That this joyous, peaceful, fulfilling state is in reality one's own inner essence has been the basic tenet of every great spiritual teacher. The kingdom of God is within you. A high is any state of consciousness above one's customary level. Therefore, to a person who lives in fear, moving up to courage is a high. To people who live in hopelessness or apathy, anger is a high. Fear feels at least better than despair, and pride feels far better than fear. Acceptance is much more comfortable than courage, and love makes any lower state seem comparatively unattractive. While joy surpasses all lesser human emotion, ecstasy is a rarely felt emotion in a class by itself. The most sublime experience of all is the state of infinite peace at level 600, so exquisite that it belies all attempts at description. The higher the level of these states, the greater is its power to reprogram the subject's entire life. Not uncommonly, just one instant in a very high state can completely change a person's orientation to life, their goals, and values. It can be said that the individual who was is no more, and a new person is born out of the experience. Through hard-won progress on a dedicated spiritual path, this is the very mechanism of spiritual evolution. The high-state experience, which may be legitimately attained through a lifetime of dedicated inner spiritual work, can, however, be reached temporarily by artificial means. But the balance of nature dictates that to artificially acquire that state without having earned it creates a debt, and the negative imbalance results in negative consequences. The cost of such stolen pleasure is the desperation of addiction, and finally both the addict and society pay a price. Ours is a society which idealizes the pleasureless, such as hard work, stoicism, self-sacrifice, restraint, and tends to condemn pleasure in most of its simpler forms, frequently even declaring them to be illegal. Politicians, whether secular or ecclesiastic, understand this phenomenon well. A ploy of local politicians to gain headlines is the public announcement of intents to prohibit pleasures in the prisons or deny the inmates tobacco or TV or magazines. In our society, unfulfilled promise and enticement are legitimized, but satisfaction is denied. Commercialized sexual allure, for instance, is used to sell many products endlessly. But the enjoyment of actual commercial sex is forbidden as immoral. Historically, all ruling classes have achieved status and wealth by controlling society through some kind of puritanical ethic. The harder underlings work and the more meager their pleasures, the richer will be the ruling system, whether they be theocracy, aristocracy, oligarchy, or corporate industry barony. Such power is built upon the forfeited pleasure of the workers. Experientially, as we have seen, pleasure is merely high energy. The energies of the masses have been co-opted over the centuries to produce for the overclasses the very wealth of pleasures denied the underclasses. In truth, the pleasure of the life energy is mankind's best capital. Robbing man of this has resulted in the wide division between the haves and the multitudes of have-nots. What working classes envy in the lives of upper classes is their pleasures, from the pleasures of the exercise of power and its varied forms, to the beautiful trophies of self-indulgence. The realization that the pleasures denied oneself are being enjoyed by others begets the outrage of revolution, or, sublimated, the repression of restrictive laws against the pleasures of one's peers.
This concludes Disc 2. Disc 3, New Horizons in Research, continued.
The moral code thus functions as a rationalized exploitation of the life energy of the masses through a calculated distortion of values. The illusion proffered is that the more hellish one's life, the more heavenly will be one's reward. The distorted coupling of pleasure with suffering has produced a morally perverse social milieu in which pain becomes associated with pleasure. In this atmosphere, the extreme alternation of suffering and euphoria that typifies addiction becomes at least provisionally tenable in a deadly antisocial game of winning and losing the forbidden high. From the same life view arises society's method of treating the problem by playing the other half of the game, denying the substance of abuse. By doing so, we have created a marketplace that is so highly lucrative and easily entered that a whole criminal industry flourishes as a result, corrupting life on multiple levels. The arrest of a drug kingpin, for instance, has no effect at all on the drug problem overall. Before he is even jailed, he will already have been replaced by a new replacement. In the recent demise of the South American drug lord Escobar, he was instantly replaced by three new kingpins, so that Hydra now had three heads instead of one. Society's drug problem requires a social approach calibrating at 350, and society's current anti-drug program calibrates at only 150. It is therefore ineffective, and the money spent is wasted.
Industrial and scientific research.
The diagnostic method we have described quickly tracks fruitful areas for research and development in science and industry. Historical examples illustrate how the use of this method can save years of effort and millions of dollars.
Materials research.
Thomas Edison tested over 1,600 substances before he arrived at tungsten as the most suitable element to be used for his historic development of the incandescent light bulb. An easier way to detect the best material was simply to divide the possible alternatives into two groups and ask, "The material I am seeking is in this group, yes or no?" After that determination, the group is again subdivided and so on. By this method, an answer can be arrived in a matter of exactly 3 minutes rather than years.
Product development.
RJR Nabisco Corporation spent approximately $350 million to research and produce a smokeless cigarette on the mistaken assumption that smoking is primarily an oral habit. In fact, it has been discovered clinically that when people go blind, they stop smoking. Smoking has multiple bases, of which oral gratification is only one, and even minor. A kinesiologic test of the market viability of any potential product, including the one mentioned, can arrive at clear conclusions regarding public acceptance and feasibility of marketing in less than a minute. Product acceptability and profitability can be ascertained very accurately if questions are phrased with precision, and all contingencies are investigated, including timing, markets, advertising, and subpopulations to be addressed.
Scientific inquiry.
Science provides a field of kinesiologic exploration that offers a group of inquirers excitement eclipsing any parlor game. It is also fascinating for a group to compare what they have discovered with the discoveries of other groups using the same method. In a more general application, avenues for fruitful research can be identified quickly, and it will be discovered that often the most valuable insights to be obtained have to do with the range and dimension of the research. Because this method bypasses limitation of context, one of the most valuable uses is as a check on the process itself, i.e., whether or not it is a correct direction to take. We may thus confirm that basic premises from which inquiries originate have validity. For instance, our current search for life elsewhere in the universe takes the form of broadcasting into space the mathematical symbol pi. Implicit herein is the assumption that no civilization could develop radio reception unless it could understand that mathematical concept. But it is so enormously presumptuous to assume that life elsewhere is even three-dimensional or detectable by human senses at all, let alone be composed of discrete life units, that solve problems by use of an intellect and employ symbols to communicate across space and time.
Medical science.
Kinesiologic diagnosis is a science in its own right, as reflected by the International College of Applied Kinesiology. Each organ of the body has its corresponding detector muscle, whose weakness signals pathology in the corresponding organ. Kinesiology is already widely used to confirm both diagnosis and the efficacy of a probable therapy. The right dose of the right medicine can also be determined by the patient's kinesiologic response. Similarly, allergies can be detected, and the need for nutritional supplements may be determined.
Research in theology, epistemology, and philosophy.
Though the validity of its application may vary with the capacity for awareness of the observer, the technique of using kinesiology to ascertain truth itself calibrates at a level of 600 as a methodology. This means that the method described itself has a degree of reliability which is beyond duality or the realm of ordinary consciousness as we know it in daily life. The level of truth of this book as a whole is approximately 750. To maintain that level throughout, the truth of every chapter, page, paragraph, etc., has been examined by use of the method described, and the statements and conclusions have been similarly verified. The confusion surrounding the nature of truth can be mitigated if we calibrate the level of truth of our questions as well as the answers. Paradoxes and ambiguities arise from confusing levels of consciousness. An answer is true only at its own level of consciousness. Thus, we may find that an answer is correct, but simultaneously invalid, like a musical note that is correctly played but at the wrong place in the score. All observations are reflections of specific levels of consciousness and are valid only on their own level. Every means of approaching a subject, therefore, has its own built-in limitations. A statement may be true at a high level of understanding but be incomprehensible to the average mind. Its value may therefore be corrupted when the statement is distorted by the limitation of the listener. This has been the fate of religions throughout the ages, where statements that originate from high levels of awareness are later misinterpreted by followers who then are invested with authority. Such distortion can be seen to an extreme degree in fundamentalist sects of any religion. The fundamentalist interpretation of religious teachings proceeding from negativity is removed by this negativity from truth. The lowest depictions of deity are of a god who is jealous, vengeful, and angry, a god of death far removed from the god of mercy and love. The god of righteous negativity represents a glorification of the negative and provides for followers a disavowal of responsibility through justification of human cruelty and mayhem. Pain and suffering in general increase as one nears the bottom levels of consciousness. The truth of each level of consciousness is self-verifying in that each level has its native range of perception, which confirms what is already believed to be true. Thus, everyone feels justified in the viewpoints which underlie their actions and beliefs. That is the inherent danger of all so-called righteousness. Anyone can be righteous, from the killer who justifies his rage, to ecclesiastic demagogues and political extremists of all persuasions. By distorting context, it is possible to rationalize and justify virtually any human behavior. The human dialogue is awesome in its enormity and subtlety, reflecting the kaleidoscopic interactions of the powerful attractor energy fields which constitute man's consciousness. The brilliance of the world's great philosophers through 25 centuries has been staggering in its scope and complexity. Yet, overall, there are few areas of agreement as to the nature of truth itself. Without an objective yardstick, every individual who has ever lived has had to sift through the changing reflections of life to discern their own truth. This seems a never-ending struggle to which man is condemned by virtue of his own mental design. This design predicates that any statement will be true only within a given context, despite the fact that the definitions and derivations of that context are invisible and unstated. It is as though every individual is exploring life with a compass that has a unique setting. That any meaningful dialogue at all is possible bespeaks man's enormous compassion for his own condition and attests that giving cohesion to the whole is an all-inclusive, overarching attractor field that facilitates the manifestation of the possible into the actual. Concordance emerges from the organizing patterns hidden behind apparent chaos. Thus, the evolution of mankind progresses despite the apparently aberrant signals of individuals in any given moment. Chaos is only a limited perception. Everything is part of a larger whole. Everyone is involved in the evolution of the all-inclusive attractor field of consciousness itself. It is this evolution, innate to the overall field of consciousness, which guarantees the salvation of mankind and with it of all life. The nobility of man is expressed as his constant struggle with his own unasked-for existence in a world which is a house of mirrors, his sole support, his faith in the process of life itself.
Chapter 7. Everyday Critical Point Analysis.
The potential applications for research we have described thus far give some suggestion of the limitless uses to which this method lends itself. As the interaction of attractor fields of energy with human consciousness reveals itself at the interaction of mind and body, the basic level of available energy in any enterprise can be calibrated. All that is required is to have two people, one of whom is familiar with the muscle testing technique. The practical implications are staggering. This tool can be as germinal to the continuing evolution of society as any of the major discoveries of the physical sciences. Let us spell out in more detail what this could mean in everyday life. Inasmuch as the calibrated power of an identified attractor pattern is directly related to its degree of truth, it is possible to clearly distinguish truth from falsehood, constructive from destructive, the practical and efficient from the unworkable and wasteful. We can identify motive, agenda, and goal in any project or within individuals themselves. Sheep's clothing need no longer hide the wolf. As we have seen, consciousness reacts decisively to the difference between truth and falsehood. You may instantly confirm this by stating your age, which will make your arm go strong, and then if you state your incorrect age, your arm will go weak. Like a computer, consciousness simply answers 0 or 1, true or false. Any ambiguities in the process are introduced by the questioning method, not the answering mechanism, as we will describe later. We can identify the level of truth of any statement, belief system, or body of knowledge. We can accurately measure the truth of any sentence, paragraph, chapter, or book, including this one. We can reliably identify our own level of consciousness or motive in any enterprise. We now have available a perspective on social movements and history never before possible. Political research, for instance, is not confined only to the present. Instead, we can look back into history to make calibrations. For instance, to compare Gorbachev with Stalin, Trotsky with Lenin, and so on. In all of these exercises, kinesiology reveals the hidden implicit order by making it explicit and disclosing its true nature. The use of the system is self-educative and self-directing. Each answer, it will be discovered, leads to the next question, happily in an upward and beneficial direction. We discover the truth about ourselves because our questions themselves are merely the reflections of our own motives, goals, and levels of awareness. It is always informative to calibrate not the answer, but the question. In discussing the process, we must emphasize again, more specifically, some aspects of the form of questioning. Precision in wording is of paramount importance. The question might be posed, for instance, is this decision a good one? But what do we mean by the word good? Good for whom? And in what time frame? Therefore, questions have to be very carefully defined. What we think is good or bad are merely subjective, and what the universe thinks about it may be quite something else. Motive in questioning is highly significant. Always ask first, I may ask this question. Never ask a question unless you are prepared for the answer. The facts may be quite different from what you currently believe. Though there is a potential for emotional upset through the unwise use of the method, experience has shown that continuing the line of inquiry will enlarge the context and heal the disturbance. Let us say, a young woman asks, "My boyfriend is honest. He is good for my life, and the answers are negative. Wow, she is disappointed to find his love is selfish and his interest exploitive." But further questions provide then a resolution. She asks, "This relationship would end in emotional pain." The answer she gets is yes. "Therefore, I am saving myself a lot of misery now by knowing this." The answer is yes. "I can learn from this experience." Yes. And thus we see the benefit when it is completed. On a more mundane level, the same technique can determine whether an investment is an honest one or not, or whether an institution can be trusted. We can accurately predict the potential of new developments, not only in marketing, but in medical research or engineering. We can check the safety precautions being used on great oil tankers. We can judge in advance the advisability of military strategy. We can ascertain who is really fit to govern and distinguish the statesman from the mere politician. In the case of a media event, we can instantly tell whether the interviewer or the interviewee is telling the truth, and if they are, what level of truth is being expressed. If you try this during a news hour, you may have the shocking discovery that on some occasions even all the public figures are lying. Want to tell if that's a good used car to buy? Easy. Want to find out if a salesman is telling the truth? Simple. Want to know if your new romantic interest is a good bet? You want to know this is a reliable product, that this employee is trustworthy. What is the degree of safety of a new device? Will this device be successful or a flop? What is the integrity, skill, and competence level of a particular doctor or lawyer? Who is the best available therapist, teacher, coach, repairman, mechanic, or dentist? What levels of consciousness are required to properly discharge the duties of specific public offices? And what are the levels of the current incumbents? This capacity to instantly differentiate truth from falsehood is of such extraordinary potential value to society that we have felt it appropriate in our research to document and verify some very explicit practical applications.
Current and historic events.
Because the technique immediately distinguishes true from false evidence, it can resolve factual disputes. The identity of perpetrators, for instance, or the whereabouts of missing persons. The truth underlying major news events can also be revealed, for instance, the guilt or innocence of victims or accusers, also the validity of historic conspiracy theories or unresolved mysteries, such as the Amelia Earhart story, the Lindbergh kidnapping, etc. Also, testimony before Senate hearings and media reports of events are verifiable in a matter of seconds. By use of this technique, for instance, it will be discovered that a major sports figure who recently served a prison term is actually innocent, and his accuser was lying. In another recent prominent case, the accuser is telling the truth, and the accused is still holding a high office.
Health research.
The failure to eradicate certain diseases or find their cure is often due to the fact that reason is its own limitation. False answers often preclude searching for true causes. For instance, it is current dogma that tobacco causes cancer. Our research, on the contrary, revealed that organically grown tobacco tests kinesiologically strong, whereas commercial tobacco tests weak. Tobacco was not noted as a carcinogen before 1957, and it does so now as the result of chemicals introduced into its manufacture at the time. There are other solutions to smokers' lung cancer. Research reported in the magazine Science in 1995 indicates that 1 gram per day of vitamin C prevents cell damage from smoking. But the real solution is to identify and remove the carcinogenic chemicals from the manufacturing process.
Criminal justice and police work.
To know whether a witness is lying is of obvious importance in any case under investigation, but it is equally significant to discover whether the prosecution is withholding evidence, or if a jury has been tampered with, or, for that matter, is even capable of understanding the evidence. One of the most interesting applications of the technique is in crimes where there are no witnesses, and it is the word of the accuser against that of the accused. The rash of allegations of sexual crimes against prominent people is an obvious example. Public figures are very easy targets for politically motivated character assassination. And in a society where defendants are treated by the media as if proven guilty merely by virtue of having been accused, they need public protection as much as the accusers.
Statistics and methodology. Time saving.
Great amounts of money and time are spent gathering data to document what could be discerned in a matter of a few minutes. For instance, to prove the validity of the kinesiologic method itself to the skeptical, the following procedures had to be followed. 15 different small groups totaling 360 subjects were tested with both positive and negative stimuli. And in concordance, the statistical analysis revealed that P was less than 0.001. Secondly, 7 large groups totaling 3,300 volunteers were similarly tested, and P was again less than 0.001. A third group of 325 subjects were tested individually, and in them the concordance rate P was less than 0.001. A fourth group, 616 psychiatric patients, were tested in groups and individually. In that group, concordance was again, P was less than 0.01. The conclusion from all the above was that the null hypothesis was rejected. By comparison, traditional methodologies are inefficient.
Politics and government.
Are our leaders telling us the truth? Is a political figure upholding the Constitution of the United States or subverting it for personal gain? Does a particular candidate have the unique capacity to rise to the demands of the office he or she seeks? Are facts being misrepresented by a government agency or spokesperson? Will a proposed policy actually solve the problem for which it is designed? Such practical issues can now be addressed with certitude. Political debates and public addresses can be analyzed for factuality, and proposed legislation can be assessed from a clearer perspective. Programs that are worthwhile can be definitely identified, and ineffective programs can be dropped.
Commerce.
It is possible to diagnose an ailing business or industry and solve its problems without risking financial resources or experiments. Complete analysis of a business starts with calibrating the current and past levels of collective motivation, and then the abilities of all the people concerned in its operation. Next, one may calibrate what level needs to be reached by the various departments in order to succeed. Then policies, personnel, products, supplies, advertising, marketing, and hiring procedures can be similarly assessed. Various market strategies can then be investigated without investment in expensive market analysis, which preserves capital while saving enormous amounts of time and energy. It is wise to remember that in the conventions of commerce, like those of politics, truth has an ambiguous status. There is a universally accepted implicit understanding that things said to gain advantage are not held to any standard of personal honesty. A convenient conscience regarding the exaggerated claim, the bluff, the white lie, is as much a part of the garb of the marketplace as the business suit and tie. In fact, intriguingly, kinesiologic analysis commonly tells us to no longer believe an erstwhile trustworthy person once they have donned a suit and a tie. Therefore, numerous applications arise in everyday business. For instance, to determine whether a bill or invoice is accurate. A padded account will make any investigator's arm go weak, as will inferior quality or workmanship. Fraud and bogus imitations are easily detectable. The technique can quickly differentiate a bad check from a good one, a false diamond from a true gem.
Chapter 7. Everyday Critical Point Analysis Continued. Science and Research.
The level of truth of any scientific paper, experiment, or theory is easily determinable. A great potential asset to the scientific community and the public at large. The benefits to be derived from a given direction of investigation can be ascertained in advance, as can the value of alternative avenues of research. Examination of the economics of research projects and the capabilities of investigators and equipment is also of practical value. Critical factor analysis can detect the point in a system at which the least effort is capable of producing the greatest result. Computer simulation, with all its complex and uncertain variables,